Gaither. He began his Buddhist practice in 1995 in the Vipassana tradition before studying Zen in 2003 with Roshin Paul Haller Roshi. Daigon received lay ordination in 2006, where he was given the name Daigon, which means great vow, and received Soto Zen ordination in July of 2011. He speaks internationally on a variety of topics, particularly around gender, sexuality, social justice, and their intersections with the Dharma. He sits on numerous boards, committees that serve community needs and further justice causes. He's got a BA in philosophy and religion from San Francisco State and an MA in Buddhist studies. He teaches all over internationally. So Daigon, welcome.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you all for being here. This is one of my favorite places to come and to swim in the ocean of the Dharma with you. And so I'm always grateful to have an opportunity to come and be with you. And today I was thinking about, yesterday I was having a conversation with someone, and in the course of our conversation, I found myself thinking about the koan that ends with the line, not knowing is most intimate. And then this morning I was again, I do a well-being ceremony every morning. And during the ceremony this morning, I was thinking about this very mind is Buddha, which is another sort of turning phrase in a Zen koan. And what that led me to is to talk a little bit about what is the Buddhist ideas about the mind. What do we mean when we say mind? What is it that we're pointing at? What difference does it make how we think about it? Personally, I think it makes a lot of difference because my mind is a very, it's the place where most of the tricks of my habitual formations reside. And it's my mind that is often the most dishonest with me. And it's my mind that I find myself most at odds with often. And so understanding what it is and ways that we can think about our minds can help us as we start to unravel centuries of colonial patriarchy, but also just the centuries of habits of mind that we carry with us. So there's a couple of things that I think are really vital. And I almost always, when I'm giving meditation instruction, I almost always try to include saying to people that minds are meant to think. That's what they do. That's what they're designed to do. And so thinking is not a problem. And I think that a lot of people, when we begin to meditate, we think that the thinking is the problem. That I sit down on the cushion and my mind begins to race, and that's a problem. And over my years of practice, the one thing I know is that my thinking isn't the problem, it's what I do about my thinking. Am I following myself down a rabbit hole and latching on to the thinking as some kind of truth, and then investing in reifying that and making it real? Or do I just let my mind think the thoughts that it wants to think, and I just continue to sit there and watch that as it unfolds? And the truth is depending on the day, I do both. And sometimes it's depending on the moment, I do both. So the other thing to understand about the mind is that the mind is not separate from our body. And I think that particularly here in the United States, we're often taught to think of the mind and the body as separate. I mean, even if you think about healthcare, and you know, we have mental health resources that are separate from the medical or physical health resources. And we often think of and attach moral and ethical shortcomings to mental health concerns, while not doing the same with physical stuff. And it was really fascinating for me to recognize that not only are the mind and body linked, but that they're actually the same thing that make up this. They're just skandhas of this skin bag, of this particular set of karmic causes and conditions. And so not only are they linked and influence each other, but they're the same thing. And so by caring for my mind, I care for my body. And by caring for my body, I care for my mind. And I think that in this time of isolation and in this time of separation, I think it's really important for us to recognize that we can continue to care for our bodies and our mind. And that how we do that and how we practice with that matters. I often say that when people who are not Buddhist or are just meeting me in some other capacity, when they ask me what I do, oftentimes I say that I teach embodiment practice. Because I see practice, this thing we call Buddhism, this thing that we have, we call the Dharma that has been handed to us, I often think of it as a practice of embodiment. And that it's a way for us to learn how to take up residence in our bodies that have often been the site of trauma and problems, but also of difficulties and strained. We have this strained relationship often. And so part of what I think Buddhist practice continually teaches me is how to come into relationship to this embodied experience, to this set of skandhas, to this skin bag, to this set of karmic causes and conditions. So when the turning phrase, this very mind is Buddha, what does that really mean? And for me, it continually reminds me that whatever I'm thinking, whatever's going on, that's Buddha. That is my expression of Buddha. And that is an expression of the Dharma, whether or not I think it's right, whether or not I think it's wholesome, whether or not I think it's skillful. What I think doesn't matter, because it is what it is. And even by the time that I perceive of it, the moment has passed and the experience has already happened, and I can't take those back. And so the ability to try and interrupt the stories I create and the feelings I have about my thoughts or behaviors and interrupt my feelings about my thoughts and behaviors by just thinking for a brief moment that, oh, wait, this is just an expression of Buddhahood. Okay. That's angry Buddha. Because it helps release that hold of shame and judgment that I often get tripped up by. And then I can't unpack and undo the causes and conditions that brought me to that place of reacting in a way that whatever the habit of mind was. So for me, that idea of this very mind is Buddha is a great interruption for my feelings about what's happening. And this morning in context, I was doing a prostration and my back went out and I couldn't get back up. And I just was like, oh, it was the day after my birthday and oh my God, I'm old and oh, I'm out of shape and I'm not, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I just sort of interrupted it by saying out loud, this very mind is Buddha. And it released that enough that I could just kind of go, oh yeah, well, how about if I just roll over on my back and lay there for a minute and let the spasm pass, and then I can see what else is going on. It doesn't mean that it's not, none of that stuff isn't true. Like, yes, I am out of shape. And yes, it was the day after my birthday. And yes, I am old. And that's okay. Like, I would much rather be old than not be old. Meaning, you know, there are numerous places in my life where I was not given an opportunity to grow old. Where I was told that you were going to die. So given the alternatives, I'll take being old. And then the idea of this not knowing is most intimate. One of the things that my mind does is convince itself that it's right and that this is how it is. And oftentimes, not only is this is how it is, but it's also this is how it will always be. And being able to sort of break that up a little bit with this idea that maybe so, it may be true in this moment, but who knows what's true in the next moment. And if I cannot pour concrete on and turn into a thing, this thought, so that it's stuck as the truth, but I can sort of allow it to be more amorphous, allow it to be a both and, begin to have the ability to hold complex ideas about a lot of things. You know, I think that I had, in the earlier parts of my life, I had these moments where ethics was a very black and white sort of thing. It was right or it was wrong. And even early in my Buddhist life, you know, there was skillful and there was unskillful. Kusala or akusala. Just means leading me towards liberation or leading me away from liberation. Now, it's a little more amorphous. It's a little less convinced by my own certainty, because what that allows me to do is I get to be a little more vulnerable, because part of the certainty for me was a guard against suffering. It was a guard against fear. It was a guard against letting people close enough that they could hurt me. You know, and so this not knowing has allowed me to be more vulnerable in my world and with my friends and in relationships, and to really just sort of not be so convinced. And I will say that it's also a very good thing to think about when I'm being praised for something. And the conversation it came up in was somebody was praising me for something. And I thought, at first it was like, oh yeah, this feels really good. And thank you. And okay, that's really awesome. And then for a moment I was like, oh yeah, I am really awesome. And da 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 da, and yada, yada, yada. And then I thought, but that's really only true right now. It helps me to not buy the stories that people want to say about me. Because it's always pointing me back to this, maybe so. When I first started coming around San Francisco Zen Center, it was actually through Zen Hospice Project, and it was through being a volunteer caregiver at Zen Hospice Project that I ended up meeting my teacher. And but one of the things that I really love was one of the first things I ever heard about Suzuki Roshi was this quote that is attributed to him that is, the secret to Zen is two words. Not always so. I find that funny, and I still find it funny, and I find it completely true repeatedly. Can I not be so convinced by my own stories? Can I begin to notice the habits of mind as they happen, but also not turn them into something that must be wrestled into oblivion? Can I allow myself the opportunity to just let my mind think? I don't necessarily have to attach myself to any of them. I can just allow them to come and go. Can I not be at war with my own life? I think at the end of the day, that's the best I can hope for most of the time. So I like to leave time for other people to share and to ask questions or talk about what's happening in their practice or whatever you want to talk about. I just really appreciate swimming in this sea of Dharma together. So thank you very much for your attention. And please just unmute and ask questions. Let me change the view here, if I can remember how to do that. Q, did you have a question? Oh, no, just saying thank you.
I had a question.
Okay, Loki.
When you watch it come and go, the thoughts, the narratives, does it ever slow down or does it sometimes speed up? Just curious. Or does it ever just become quiet? Just wondering how.
Oh, yeah. Of course it does. Especially the less I get involved in messing with it. You know, one of the things that happens on long retreats is you know, you spend so much time swimming in your own mind that at some point it starts to quiet down and you stop resisting and you start to just, and then the less I mess with it, the more settled it becomes, right? Mm-hmm. Because oftentimes the flurry of it is my getting in and messing with it, adding to it, taking away, being in opposition to it or liking it or thinking, oh, that's some progress or that's not some progress. So, you know, I think that that's the gift of a daily meditation practice, is that if you sit every day, you begin to, your mind starts to settle a little quicker and you begin to not mess with it so much because you just are so familiar with it. Like, that's the other thing. Like right now, I'll say I'm often bored by my own thoughts right now. I don't find them very interesting. I've been thinking them for a very long time and they're not very entertaining anymore. So, and some days are better than others and some days it works and some days it doesn't. And, but, you know, trying not to be convinced, that's why this, you know, not knowing thing is so good, because I don't have to be convinced one way or another about it. Like the times when it's calm and tranquil and settled, they're really no different than the times when it's agitated and loud and a cacophony of things. They're just different expressions of the exact same thing.
So the other part of that not knowing is most intimate. How is the most intimate? I mean,
not knowing means that we have to get close to something to see it. We begin to look closer at our own ideas. We begin to look closer at our own heart, our own desires, our own wishes. We begin to get close. So when we don't know, it calls for an investigation, right? Yeah. And so in order to investigate, we have to move a little closer. And I don't think that, and I don't know about anybody else, I did not grow up being taught to get closer to myself. If anything, the idea was to not, that I just had to do what was on in front of me, right? To just solve these problems and make it through.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I had a couple of thoughts. The first.
Tell me your name.
Oh, Ren.
Ren. Okay, thank you.
About the not knowing is most intimate. I heard something earlier this week that came to mind when you were speaking, which is that if there's trust, that there is something that you don't know. There's something unknown. Mm-hmm. There be trust. And in relationships and all that, I was just thinking about that kind of vulnerability of like that safety where you have to trust somebody in order to be able to reach that kind of new level of intimacy. That's something that kind of came to mind. But then I had a question too, which is when you were saying the mind is Buddha, I was kind of taking it as the mind is a teacher. Like when we notice ourselves getting tripped up over something and starting to stumble, and we can kind of back and observe and go, well, this is a teaching lesson of like, being able to see how either attached I was or just being able to like have a curious kind of mind about it. So I don't know if I was taking that the right way or if there was something else meant by that.
No, that's exactly right. And it goes even further though, because what it does is it says, and whatever we find there is only temporary. It's only momentary, right? So we step back and we investigate. Absolutely. And there is a lot to be learned from stepping back and looking. but then don't make that permanent, right? Like, my default setting is that most people don't like me, right? So anytime there's conflict in any relationship, it's because people don't like me. That's just default. That's where my mind instantly goes. And I was talking to a therapist one time about just that thing. And I said to them, you know, and I really wish that it wasn't always that way. And she said, well, it's not. And then pointed out numerous times when it wasn't that way. And I thought, oh yeah. Like I learned this thing and then it became my thing, right? And I was so convinced by it that it just became my default by default, right? And so I just carried it around with me as if it were real. So, you know, it's this combination of, yes, let the moment teach us, but then let that lesson go so that we can meet the new moment and learn from it, right? Yeah. Did that say something? Thank you.
Carl, you're muted.
Diagon, thank you so much for being with us tonight and for your Dharma talk. As we close, let's sit together for a minute or two and we'll dedicate the merit of our time together with some metta. So let's sit. May the merit of our practice together here today in Sangha and hearing the Dharma be for the benefit of each and every one of us, and may that benefit spread to all beings everywhere. May we all and all beings be happy and have the causes of happiness in our lives. May each of us and all beings everywhere be healthy in body and in mind. And may we all and all beings be safe and free from danger and from harm. And may we all and all beings everywhere live with ease and well-being. And may we all and all beings ultimately be free. Diagon, thank you again for being here with us and for your Dharma talk. And thank you all for being with us on this Monday evening. We are a self-organized, self-supporting little Sangha, like I said earlier, almost 19 years old. And it's really only through the generosity of everyone who has come through the doors of our centers where we've met or attended our Zooms that has kept us thriving. And just like the Dharma has continued for these 2,600 years, just through the generosity of teacher, and student and community members of giving, which is the Buddha taught was the foundation of the spiritual life.